everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's October 2023, and this is episode 363, which is an in-depth conversation about the horror film genre. On this episode, I'm joined by journal writer Cole Burgett, who is a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and the Moody Bible Institute. Cole teaches classes in Bible exposition and systematic theology. He also writes extensively about theology and popular culture. Cole has written an online cultural apologetics feature viewpoint article about horror films. Now, our viewpoint articles address relevant contemporary issues in discernment and classic apologetics, theological debates, Christian ethics, and cultural apologetics, all from a particular perspective that's usually not shared by all Christians. But we hope that our listeners and readers thinking through these viewpoint issues will be stimulated and enhanced whether or not you end up agreeing with the author. So we hope you will stick with our podcast today. Cole's article is called, Oh the Horror, One Christian's Analysis of a Controversial Genre. And you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. Cole, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
Always good to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, as I mentioned, Halloween is almost upon us and it's October. And so we cover some of these different kinds of related topics. In fact, it was a request on our YouTube channel. Someone said, could you cover these things? And we had already planned to talk about horror films before I got that request. And I would say we have covered horror films in the past in the print journal, but this is going to be a kind of a different approach. So basically, before we get started in depth, I just want to ask you a little bit about the genre, the horror film genre, and also, you know, why would Christians even consider this? I think in the month of October, people think that horror films are demonic or evil, that we should not go anywhere near them as a Christian. And then in addition, maybe you could just give us some background on horror films. In other words, what's the history of them to have some context for why even we would be talking about this topic at all?
Sure. So the roots of horror, just the genre, broadly speaking, reach well back into history, into mythology. You can even find what today, I guess, we would call horror tropes in the Bible. A good example of this would be the account of the Witch of Endor, which is essentially a kind of seance scene. So those kinds of tropes, if you will, go back well into history. But if we're specifically going to be talking about horror films, what are the roots of horror movies? You can trace those, and I'm primarily going to be talking about them in an American context. You can trace them primarily to the classic, what is called classic horror films produced by Universal Studios anywhere from the 1920s to the 1950s. Those films are where the popular image of so many classic monsters, the types of characters we think of on Halloween, right? Classic Dracula, Frankenstein, the Wolfman or the Werewolf, the Mummy, the Bride of Frankenstein, even all of those characters were sort of solidified in the popular culture's imagination by the classic horror films, the Gothic horror films or the Universal monster films. There's a lot of different names for it, but those are the films that really brought the genre to the fore and established it as really an essential and critical part of the American cinematic canon, if you will. You cannot begin to look at the horror genre without touching Universal Studios because so much of it started there. Now, along the way, in the 60s, and really going into the 70s is where you see this, the shift, broadly speaking, from a more, let's say, tame kind of horror, what we now call classic horror, to the subgenre that is now very popular today, the slasher film, emerges in the, in the 70s. And there were some films in the 60s that contributed to its rise, that contributed to those types of films being made. An example of that would be Psycho, the classic Alfred Hitchcock film in 1960. Some critics have said that the infamous shower scene in that film is sort of the moment the slasher subgenre started its ideas started. The way it was filmed, the way it was shot, the subject matter, that kind of a thing.
Well, and also I would think that yes, there's the slasher film and we think of, you know, Friday the 13th and Freddy Krueger and all those things. But I also think in the 60s, was it the 60s where we had The Exorcist and you got into some of those kind of like more demon possession type subgenre?
Yeah, those films started coming out in the early 70s. The late 60s, I think, had Rosemary's Baby. I'm not 100% sure. I think Rosemary's Baby was 68. It might have been 69. The late 60s, Rosemary's Baby, and then directly into the early 70s was The Exorcist. The Exorcist was 73. And so you see this trend toward more, let's say, risque topics. You also had it in 68, Night of the Living Dead, the Romero horror film.
Zombies. Because that's
brought in, yes, that brought in the zombies. So you start to see the genre evolving as movies in that time. And that's not to say that, you know, no zombie film ever existed. Before that, there were a couple actually that were done in black and white very early on. I'm talking about the films that sort of codified the ideas that we currently have about horror films, or have had about horror films since about the end of the 20th century. These were the films that started that. These are the tent poles, the big ones, how the films that move the genre along. And the slasher film specifically, even though, you know, that one scene in Psycho, a lot of critics will try to trace that as being the beginnings of the genre. You're not going to see I call it the metamorphosis of the genre. You won't see the metamorphosis complete until 1974 with the release of a now absolutely iconic horror film, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You know, at the time, one of the most disturbing films ever released. And it really ushered in this era of slasher films. Within 4 years of that movie, John Carpenter would release Halloween, the original Halloween, which brought Michael Myers to the fore, and you began this trend toward a new kind of sort of movie monster, this sort of vaguely defined, shapeless sort of killer, if you will, that become very popular. And the influence of those films on the genre can't be really overstated. Writing for Novel Suspects, there's a film analyst named Josh Bell, and he notes actually that there was this whole generation of filmmakers that sort of grew up watching slasher movies at sleepovers and summer camps in the 80s, coming out of the 70s, going into the 80s, these sort of Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, Wes Craven's film, going into the 80s and early 90s. And now that those kids have grown up, those types of films have become a major influence on horror filmmaking. So I don't think it's really tough to argue that the slasher subgenre sort of dominates in the modern pop culture imagination of what a horror film is. It's not to say that's the only kind, and there certainly isn't. I think there are some very good horror films out there that are not that. But it is the dominant force.
And I don't even think that includes the new subgenre, or I don't know if it's a newer one, but just kind of the approach of M. Night Shyamalan too.
No, and you have to, as much as I love genre studies, we have to understand that it is, in a sense, fluid. For example, where is the line that demarcates horror and thriller? There is a very real sense in which one can argue that The Exorcist is not a horror film in any sort of traditional sense, that it is in fact just a thriller with a supernatural twist. M. Night Shyamalan, The Village, incorporates horror tropes, but is never really thought of as a horror film. It's more of a kind of a souped up thriller with horror tropes. So I guess probably the way to argue this would be, what you tend to see happening is the influence of the horror genre, these early types of horror films, on future filmmakers, where they, even if they're not making a horror film, they pull in horror film techniques. The techniques of these films that were, I'm talking, you know, very tangible filmmaking techniques, camera angles, Dutch angles, things like that. They grab them and incorporate them in their own films because they've learned from watching these films that, well, if you just twist the camera sideways and you shoot it at a little bit of a higher angle, it creates a very eerie sense watching it. It's almost like the viewer goes to, you're sort of looking down on the characters, and it creates an uneasy feeling in the viewer. So in the 21st century, the genre has progressed even further. You've seen more popular works like The Purge, which again, you can argue is not a horror film. It's like a thriller with serious horror tropes, but it's almost like this dystopian horror film. More recently, the Academy Award winning Get Out that Jordan Peele did was sort of like
that seems more like an issue film to me.
But that incorporated horror film techniques. I think it's certainly classified as a it's like a social horror film. I guess that's what you'd call this new evolution. If you're trying to put a name on the subgenre, we've evolved into kind of like a social horror phase. And again, I am talking specifically about the American tradition. It is worth pointing out that in Britain, there's a long history of horror films. In fact, in Britain in the 1960s, these are the films that actually put people like Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, who would go on to star in Star Wars with George Lucas. They were well established in Britain by this time as playing in horror films. There was a company there called Hammer Horror that sort of did their own version of Dracula. In fact, the very sort of, you know, to use the term sexy, the very sort of sexy vampire idea, that was Christopher Lee in the Hammer Horror films.
Lee, the guy from Lord of the Rings?
Christopher Lee played Saruman in the Lord of the Rings. So that idea that he's always typecast as a villain, right? He's Count Dooku, he's Saruman. Well, that's probably because he's the face of Hammer Horror as Dracula. His version of Dracula sort of, you know, sexed up the character, if you will, and made him very seductive and very charming in a way that we just hadn't seen someone like Bela Lugosi play him. And that was a very, you know, he was very popular in his time. The Hammer Horror films sort of have at the time, they were sort of considered, you know, not that great. Horror films were, you know, 60s, 70s, they weren't really looked on as being very good. Although those ideas have changed in hindsight. Now Hammer Horror occupies this kind of revered place in the tradition. And that's to say nothing of the horror films of Eastern traditions. There is a very strong Japanese horror tradition, a very strong Korean horror tradition, Chinese horror tradition. I mean, the horror genre is very malleable, and it reaches across genres. But, you know, for hearing what we're talking about in our purposes, I'm talking primarily about the American horror film tradition. So that's just a quick overview of the history of the genre.
You mentioned that there are different types around the world, you know, and just briefly, but what is universal about even exploring horror, or why it would even come up? Is it just to scare people, or, you know, try different, as you mentioned, techniques in filmmaking?
So yeah, this is actually pretty interesting. There's two facets of this I try to run down when I do talks on horror and things like that. One of them is it, in a very real sense, it's common because it preys on perhaps the one most universal human emotional language, which is fear. One can argue that, you know, love has different shades. It can go in certain directions. Hatred even has different shades, can go in different directions. But fear is a kind of a constant, and it's not hard. No one wants to be hurt. No one wants to really see the people they care about hurt. No one wants to deal with these heavier mythological concepts like fate, which is so often a theme of especially those early horror films. And we can talk more about that later. The idea of fate or let's say destiny, which I think, you know, Christians actually can speak very powerfully to something like that. So I think on one level, these films are very, I don't want to say they're easy to make because there is no such thing as a film that's easy to make. That being said, you can get a little more mileage or let's say bang for your buck. It's why so many early filmmakers will start out making horror films because they are just so easy to do. The first short film I made was a horror short. Some of my filmmaker friends, especially the ones who are more established in the industry, they started out making horror films. It seems like with all of my filmmaking people, when I talk with them, the conversation usually will go in the direction of the horror genre. And that's because they're fiscally and financially, they're just easier to do. You can, like I was saying before, you can actually get a lot of mileage. You can create an atmosphere literally just by turning the camera on its side. It creates an askewed angle that's unnatural, and it creates a sense of unease in the viewer. So I think it's popular, sort of universal, for a couple of reasons. I think it's because you can deal with fear, which is a common universal human language, if you will. And you can also just make them easily, regardless of the culture you're in. So that's just two of the reasons, one, I guess, more thematic, one more practical, that I think this particular genre stretches across time, cultures, and it's sort of commonly understood across the board.
The journal might be free online for everyone worldwide on our website, equip.org, now, but we still need you to partner with us to continue to bring you all this free content in the form of new articles every week on our website and interviews that are very thoughtful with our article authors on the Postmodern Realities podcast. So help us out with all the things, you know, helping us out with the algorithm by subscribing to the podcast, liking different videos that you see on our YouTube channel for the podcast. And by the way, you can share the podcast through our YouTube channel as well, because we put up our Postmodern Realities episodes there. And you can also help us out big time by leaving us a rating or review, specifically on Apple Podcasts. Of course, share your favorite episodes. And you can always leave us a tip. We're really grateful for tips because they do add up. And you can do that very easily by going to equip.org, hitting journal, then going to Postmodern Realities. There is a link for giving us a tip at any one of our episode landing pages. So thank you very much for your partnership, for getting the word out, for telling a friend. And now back to more on horror films with my guest today, Cole Burgett. Well, as usual, when we have one of these cultural apologetics discussions, it always has to be at the front, I think, because Christians are wondering about this particular genre. I think because of the nature of the theme itself, they might have a hard time accessing it or thinking they should watch one or could watch one, or
engage with it in any way, even though it seems to me, especially, and this could just be a stereotype, but I've always thought that not in the past, but currently some of these slasher, Friday the 13th, Freddy Krueger, and all these kinds of, you know, I know what you, what was the one about all the kids and they were, and Neve Campbell was in it and they were,
Is this the thing?
That series is still going where there's some mass murderer. Was it I Know What You Did Last Summer or something like that?
It's Scream.
Scream franchise,
which actually Scream is actually a fascinating franchise because it is a parody of so many horror tropes. Just interesting.
Yeah. And so, you know, teenagers going in the woods and all those things, that it appeals to that particular age group, I guess, you know, going out with friends. And you said some of these filmmakers in the past remember, you know, having sleepovers and watching some of these scary movies, and it went on to inspire them. But they're still popular. They're still being made because of financial reasons or whatever, or they're getting more, you know, pretty gruesome like Saw or whatever. But Christians, just the idea of saying that there's this genre, and they know, if, even if they've never watched Rosemary's Baby or The Exorcist or something, they know about it. And so why is it that Christians have a hard time accessing it? And, you know, this is a Viewpoint article. We're hoping that people can hear your perspective, even if they don't agree with it, and think through it. Why would you say Christians should be open, maybe even to looking at a classic horror film and even interacting with the genre?
Yeah, so we can tackle this one in two parts. First, we'll look at why do Christians maybe have a hard time accessing it or reservations. On one hand, it's completely understandable, and I really don't even blame them for it. I have a hard time. I make horror films, you know what I mean? I've made them, and I have a hard time accessing a large number of them. And I think part of that comes with the cultural baggage it brings with it. I think when a Christian hears that we're going to talk about horror films, they have the tendency to think, so are you saying that it's okay to watch all horror films across all time everywhere? No, actually, there are quite a few horror films I would say that are not worth your time. Don't even bother watching the trailers. And sometimes you can pick up on those just in the title alone. The titles can be sort of goofy and on the nose, and you're like, yeah, I'm not going to waste my time with that. So it's more of a, I guess, a common sense approach to it. However, there are others that largely are, and I'm freely ready to admit this, they largely are outside of the slasher subgenre. Now, I am not someone who can speak to the slasher subgenre with any real depth, because there are only a handful of them that I have seen and taken seriously. And the ones that I have seen and try to take seriously are the ones that sort of birthed the genre, if the subgenre, if you will. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is really a very disturbing film. It's very tame by modern standards. Watching the film, it's largely bloodless. It's more just thematically disturbing. I mean, there are some, you know, shocking scenes in it, but compared to something like you were saying, I just saw a trailer for a new Saw, and this is like the 10th one or something like that, and I can't watch them. I just have no interest in it. I see the trailers and nothing looks compelling to me, and I have friends who've seen it, and you know, they get mileage out of it and tracking the lore and all that, and I just can't do it. And so I think Christians have to ask themselves their personal tastes. And let's be honest, if the only types of movies you watch are horror films, there's probably an issue, because there are really good films out there that are not this genre, that tell very different stories, and those stories are just as good, if not better. But this genre in particular, I think because the slasher motifs and subgenre have dominated, and probably because the generation that's around now remember those films dominating. They remember being at summer camps in the 80s, and you know, these films being there and, you know, scaring the living daylights out of them, things like that. They remember those things, and they sort of bring them in. So when you hear horror films, that's sort of what readily comes to mind. Now, the second part of the question, how are there horror films worth a Christian's time? What makes one worth a Christian's time? Something like that. I would say that when you come to the subject matter of horrific themes, dark things, things that induce fear, that unsettle you, what you're encountering is the reality of evil. Because I would say if the only place you ever feel uneasy, or a Christian should has that kind of reaction specifically, is on the subject of horror films, then you probably don't live in touch with reality. You actually do not get through this world without encountering evil in one form or another. You can't. In fact, a good understanding of the gospel is going to begin with an understanding of the evil that is in us. And I think the best entries of the horror genre put that conversation front and center. So it's fascinating to me that we're talking about this subject in the context of apologetics with the research journal, right? Where I have always sort of maintained that an evangelistic conversation and apologetic conversation, if you're going to try to walk someone through into and through Christianity, its beliefs, its doctrines, our convictions, we have to begin with sin. We have to begin with sin. If you're not doing it from a literary biblical perspective, which you probably should, but if you're not doing it that way and you're doing it from the perspective of beliefs and doctrines, until you understand the pervasiveness, if you will, of sin and very much the reality of evil that touches all of us, until you understand that, then you don't understand the gospel. You don't understand exactly what it is Christ's sacrifice accomplishes, why it was even necessary in the first place. Those questions all sort of begin with a basic assumption, which is that, you know, for the classical apologists in the room, there is common ground. It has to begin with the basic assumption that evil is real and must be dealt with. And the horror genre fascinates me simply because it preys on that idea. It's an entire genre, if you will, of storytelling, a kind of storytelling that begins with the inherent assumption that evil is real and must be dealt with. And now you can argue that there are a lot of horror films that do not deal with that evil well, and I would completely agree. And I would say those are not worth your time, and you probably should watch them, and most of them are, in fact, slashers. However, there are others, like you said, especially those classic horror films. Why would you give a classic horror film a chance? Well, because it stands, if you look at like Dracula, Frankenstein, even the Wolfman, even though there's no, not as direct a literary precursor, things like Dracula and Frankenstein, those films, the old black and white ones, if you will, you know, they're taken from Bram Stoker's original work, Mary Shelley's original work, those classic Gothic horror novels that we sort of touch on in high school and we're told they're important, but if we actually read them, you know, we might not see it because it's written in old English or older Victorian English, and it's kind of hard to understand, even though Dracula's a very modern novel, even in its format. He's working with a bunch of different formats and things like that. But we have to understand that those classic films pull from a very rich tradition of literary horror, which I would argue is even more significant for what we're talking about here. We're dealing with evil as a mythic theme, which I think is how the Bible approaches it. Again, we've talked at length on this podcast, myth does not mean fake. Myth or mythic or mythology, this idea of the Bible is myth. The Bible, it's not saying the Bible is untrue. You can see it as factual and real, but also as having mythic dimensions. That is the very thing that seemed to convert C.S. Lewis through conversations with the likes of J.R.R. Tolkien. It is absolutely no coincidence that those Christians in the 20th century churned out some iconic works, mythic works even. They make those connections. And even though there are some Christians less well known, like an Arthur Machen, for example, who wrote horror, they're less well known, but they have this rich tradition of dealing with horror and writing on dark things for the purpose of pointing one toward what goodness is. There's a very real sense in which in these kinds of stories, goodness is only seen or is measured over against the level of darkness, the level of evil one is up against. I've often said, was told this early on, and have come to agree with it, Dracula is one of the most religious novels I've ever read. And it's often jarring for people to hear that. And I'll say the same thing with the adaptation, the 31 adaptation with Bela Lugosi, even though it's not, you know, a perfect adaptation or a one-to-one adaptation. There are very rich textures of goodness to that film. Love is painted in stronger colors because in Dracula there is none of it. And the characters who go up against him, these humans who go up against them, they're forced to sort of come to trust each other, rely on each other, and not in a very sort of a superficial kind of way, but it's the strength of faith, if you will, of the character of Van Helsing in Dracula, who has a wonderful passage in the book. He talks about this individual he calls King Laugh. He's trying to explain why he had a moment where he laughed at a funeral, which seems like a very gruesome and grim thing. But he has this wonderful explanation of this figure that he calls King Laugh, that when he shows up, you can't help but bend the knee to him. That when you, if you just changed King Laugh to King Jesus, Christians would find themselves really, they would hear what he's saying is very, you know, compelling. I mean, I understand that's not what Van Helsing is saying there. That being said, I do think Stoker is making a very profound point in that section about faith, about what it accomplishes, about what goodness actually does for you in the face of great evil. So in that sense, it's very, very religious. And I think if a Christian from an apologetic approach is looking for common ground, horror films, horror stories, even just to broaden it a little bit and just say horror stories, many horror stories provide that because, again, it begins with that basic assumption that evil is real and must be dealt with.
I think that's important just because you will hear from many folks today that people are basically good and that we just have to work together as a society. Exactly.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
So I think that some of these make us pause only in that whether or not we're wrestling with the problem of evil, I think at least at a basic level, folks that are watching it are wondering, well, how would you even think of that?
Yeah.
Even think of tormenting or, you know, taking a life or any of those kinds of things. It gets you into that conversation because even people who hold to a thesis that, which is an anti-Christian one or opposite of the Christian worldview, that everyone is basically good.
Mm-hmm. People
get murdered and there's wars.
Exactly. And what you see, to take that just a step further, you'll often see today this idea that, well, evil can just be educated out. Evil can just be medicated out. It can be therapied into remission, if you will, which I would argue is a very, very shallow view of evil.
Kind of like suppressed, right?
We can suppress. Yeah, it's this idea that you'll see floating around today that evil can be suppressed or medicated or therapied into remission. The idea that, well, if, you know, the upbringing had been different, if they had just been taught differently or shown differently, that, you know, evil would be taken care of. Well, the 20th century took care of that idea quite well. To put it in morbid terms. If that were true, then what we should see is society getting better. in fact, I would argue with the rise of social media and all the technological progress, if anything, what you see is a retrograde motion into something closer to tribalism. You don't see people coming together.
We don't obviously, unless it's like, you know, Christian ethics, should Christians vote, we don't get into politics. But I will say that, you know, the 20th century had its fair share of dictatorships, and those are exactly. Oppressive to human beings. And yet at the same time, we think, well, wouldn't we have learned from history? Why do these types of leaders keep rising? And they do. So
when you're looking at it from a, if you're looking at it from a geopolitical or a sociopolitical perspective, the argument applies. The argument, you can make the argument from multiple angles here, but they're all sort of hitting at the same thing, which again, I sort of state this way, evil is real and must be dealt with. There's no getting around that, if you will. And it sort of, you know, flies in the face again of this idea that we can just, it's easily remedied. It's an easily remedied solution, if it even exists, right? We tend to see a lot of people today who don't really have a functional view of evil as a thing, as evil as something that's there. It's not good, it's not evil. It's something in between, and then the choices you make take you in one direction or another, but there's no objectivity to it. And, you know, I think a person who is reading the Bible with a shred of literalness to their hermeneutic, with a shred of, I would argue, common sense, is going to see that that hermeneutic does not play out beyond page 4. Beyond Genesis, I don't know, 3, you're not getting very, very far in biblical studies, unless you're doing some pretty fantastic hermeneutical gymnastics to argue that evil is just not a thing that has to be accounted for and dealt with in the world today.
We did start talking about, you know, just the different genres. There are some that are extremely violent, like the recent Saw and things like that, but we didn't really delve into the genre that you started talking about, the classic Universal Studios, or maybe I would say classic works of literature that have been put onto screen also, that Christians can actually think through and get behind. But, you know, why would those kinds of horror films be worth someone's time to consider? Okay, yes, this is a great... See, here's the thing about... I want our listeners to know about cultural apologetics is... This kind of genre is so popular universally, specifically among people who are not religious in general of all ages. I mean, there's so many horror fans and horror conventions and all kinds of things. And Halloween is so big for so many people. They love to get into the spirit of this dark stuff, that if there are classic works that we can watch responsibly as Christians based on literature, you talked about Dracula and so forth. That's helpful because it really is a springboard to talk about some of the things that we were just discussing about sin and the nature of evil and the fact that evil is real.
Yeah. So these sort of classic horror films with the stuff that we've been talking about, what we see is, again, this sort of baseline morality at work in these movies. And I'll give you an example of this. In the 1931 Dracula, Bela Lugosi, whose visually his portrayal is quite different from the way that Stoker originally wrote the character. That's not to say it's not good. It's just different. But the 1931 version of Dracula with Bela Lugosi, Dracula is not, this is sort of the one I always run to, only because Twilight made it so popular. He's not a sexy vampire. You know what I mean? There's a part of him that's very compelling, but there's none of this, oh, his beauty is just so intoxicating. No. He overrides your mind. It's actually a kind of hypnosis that he uses. And, you know, watching it on screen, it may look a little corny, but it's actually a little more genuinely terrifying. If you're watching this as an adult, it's a little more terrifying than the idea of, you know, this just really attractive 20-something vampire who never looks like he ages, just showing up and looking attractive and then you falling for him. It has nothing to do with that.
I think of that as Anne Rice started that.
Yeah, Anne Rice.
Yes.
Interview with the Vampire and those types of films. Yeah, you see this kind of thing. Bela Lugosi's Dracula is someone who he has a kind of hypnosis about him. And it's pretty clear in the film that when these characters sort of fall for him, it has less to do with his charm and more with almost a supernatural sort of ability to manipulate the mind. And so what looks to be kind of affections run amok to your friends, which is what happens in the film, is really your mind being eroded away, your will being overpowered. And I think that's actually quite a scary idea, in a very different way. So that's one example of how these sort of classic horror films are so different from what we see today, and why they're, you know, fairly, I would argue, worth one's time, because there's a baseline morality at work. And this goes both ways, right? So the hero of Dracula, not necessarily the protagonist, but if there's a very sort of traditional hero character, it's the character of Abraham Van Helsing, played by Edward Van Sloan in the 1931 film. And in so many other modern horror movies, this is a character who would be sort of killed off very early on for like shock value or to make you think, well, nobody's safe in this movie. And he's just this sort of enfeebled old man who is not what I would call an action hero, but who is sound in his convictions, and he's never once taken in by evil. So you get this wonderful scene, and it's, you know, we do this very strange thing today that I've always thought was a little odd, where we like clap in theaters. I don't understand why we clap for screens. They can't hear you. But people do that. I guess it's just part of the common, it's in the warp and woof. You just clap in a theater when something happens. And I always thought that was a very strange thing. And I always kind of thought and had this belief in my head that, you know, probably before like the 1990s, people didn't do this. I'm happy to say that I stand corrected. I was reading an article, a news article. It was an early review, a then modern review of Dracula from 31. And it's actually reported that there's a scene in the film where Dracula attempts this sort of mind control thing on Van Helsing, and he's never once taken in by it. He never sways, and it leads Dracula to attempt to kill him. And it's so easily rebuffed, and it has nothing to do with, you know, it's less to do with a little crucifix, you know, that idea that you just show a vampire crucifix and they run away. It has less to do with the crucifix in the scene and more to do with Van Helsing's conviction that he has this strength of character about him that is absolutely unseduced by evil. It's not compelling to him. He sees it exactly for what it is. He's unafraid to call it. In fact, he's one of the only characters in the film, especially very early on, who is willing to say, oh no, there's nothing you can do but kill it. This is solved by driving a stake through his heart, not by talking to him, not by medicating him. You kill him. That's how you get rid of evil. You get rid of it. Nothing else. And it was reported that during this scene, that the theater that the reviewer was in actually broke out into applause. And this was all the way back in 31. And I always found that absolutely fascinating, because it is the kind of thing that I cannot think of a single modern film goer that I know who would find that particular scene powerful enough to break out into applause for, because to us it seems so tame. Almost 100 years on, well, what's so powerful about an old man standing there untaken in by this sort of mind-controlling vampire? Well, actually, it has less to do with the visuals, because there were no great visual effects. It was the character. It was the strength of character. It was really the strength of goodness, one can argue, in the face of evil. This kind of stalwart goodness that has teeth to it, that is actually greater than evil, and easily overcomes it. That sort of, those heights, if you will, of good and evil are what the best horror films aim for. And so I think that's what makes a lot of these classic horror films like Dracula so different from what we see today. I think they're important for that kind of reason.
So I want to talk more about your article itself. And, you know, we've had some snippets starting to talk about this topic, but you show that the shift in horror cinema in the United States started around the 1970s to more of what we've already called the slasher subgenre. I think today's audience thinks of horror films in that real gruesome kind of approach. Can you give us a little bit more than you just kind of touched on it? Why did suddenly it shift from more of the Psycho and, you know, Rosemary's Baby, Exorcist to this really explicit kind of approach? And why is that just the go-to for today?
I largely think it's sensationalism. Toby Hooper's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, followed very closely by John Carpenter's Halloween. Those are very successful films in one sense. Even Roger Ebert, the film critic, who was really sort of put off by The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and rightly so, he saw it as a film with no purpose. Nonetheless, said that, you know, it's a bit of a marvel of a film in its own right. It's some type of odd, you know, achievement in what it set out to do. And I think that's true. And the expression I will use in this discussion is it seems to be mindless horror. And I say that carefully because I actually do think that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre has a bit more on its mind than many of the types of films it helped create. Just like I think the original Halloween has a bit more on its mind than a lot of the sequels and the endless sequels, right, that go on and on and on. I think those originals are actually, you know, fairly well made technically. They're very sharp, even though they're sort of low budget, they're very sharp films in terms of how they're made. But beyond the technical aspects, I think there are some themes there in both of those that they're sort of daring in their audacity to show what they show, to really push the envelope. We say things like, you know, push the envelope. But what does that mean today, where we've pushed the envelope to, you know, borderline porn being acceptable in PG-13 films? What does it mean to push the envelope today? Those films pushed the envelope because of what not just what they were showing, because when you look at them, they're really tame, honestly, by comparison, than many of the films they gave rise to. But just thematically, they're so disturbing thematically. And I think that contributed to it. So in a way, I think maybe those original films, those early films in this late 60s, early 70s, and then Halloween in 78, maybe those films were popular in their time simply because they sort of had a kind of audacity to them. There was it's a bit of a renegade filmmaker kind of feel, especially with John Carpenter. But once you get into the sequels and the makings of movies beyond, you know, those originals, where it's taken sort of out of those original filmmakers' hands and put in the hands of other writers and directors, sort of, you know, milking the cash cow, if you will, you sort of lose the creative integrity and really the interesting thing. I think I've mentioned I saw and have seen both those early films. And again, I find them quite tame compared to much of what goes on today. I find them quite tame to many PG-13 movies. And I've seen a handful of the sequels and have never found them at all compelling. But I do think they dominate the pop culture imagination, the zeitgeist, if you will. They dominate the zeitgeist today simply because so many filmmakers now, people who are, you know, producing cultural artifacts today, grew up with not just the originals, but just the sequels. And the sort of the ilk that came up in their wake, like these Friday 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street type movies. That's why they sort of dominate and keep the money flowing, in today's society. And I do think, and this is probably what Christians recoil against, and rightly so, I do think that we just have to acknowledge that there are audiences out there who like the gore. That's what a lot of these films capitalize. This is part of why it's easy to make them. It is much easier to get a bucket of red paint or water and throw it at something and shock you than it is to gussy up, you know, special effects and spend millions of dollars on creating CGI assets. It's much easier and effective. It's, again, this is why I say so many starting out filmmakers will make horror films, because it's actually practical to do. It saves money, and it's not hard to evoke a reaction. And I do think we have to recognize that a lot of audiences do turn up just for the gore of it. They do take delight in the evil in some ways. I don't think we can ignore that. And so a lot of those types of films, I would say Christians are skeptical of, and rightly so. I'm just as skeptical of them. I distinctly remember being in, not even in high school, but in elementary school. I distinctly remember being in elementary school and really not being allowed to watch, you know, were some of the few movies I was only not allowed to watch, right? Credit to my parents on that one. But there were other things they should have policed, but they weren't policing that. And they did this quite well with these types of horror films. One, all of my friends in elementary school, you know, as a kid, were watching Friday the 13th. I couldn't get my mind around it. Because, you know, you always hear about them in school, and you sort of try to slip and look at it and see what it is. It just never seemed interesting to me. It seemed kind of dumb, personally. And the horror films I have very distinct and vivid memories of as a kid were these classic horror films. And those only became more important to my life as time went on. And I, you know, started studying Christian theology and things like that. I ended up seeing a lot of parallels there. So I think Christians are right to be skeptical of many of the films of the slasher subgenre today.
That subgenre does not seem edifying at all for Christians. And, you know, hopefully somebody can get some context for some of those, why they came around. But, you know, before this came into prominence, you know, I mentioned before I asked about the slasher films was some of those more classic ones. There are really different ones that you've mentioned a few times, kind of based on literature figures and so forth. And why would, you know, not only there was a shift, but why did they dominate that kind of at the time, the imagination that they would have a film about Dracula and Frankenstein and things like that?
Well, even in their day, the literary works were sort of seen as transgressive. It's mind-boggling now to look at something like a Frankenstein and think that was transgressive literarily in its day. Stoker's Dracula. Oh yeah, yeah. So I think for a lot of audiences, this was the first time they were seeing these stories. There was certainly a kind of cultural knowledge of Dracula, cultural knowledge of Frankenstein. This is the first time they were seeing these types of stories brought to life, not in Technicolor, in black and white, in a sense. But they're seeing these characters put on screen. And I really do think there is a very important visual component there to telling a story through film and picture, because that's really what it is. You're just telling a story through moving pictures. And having that visual component puts a whole new kind of life into the material. In a very different way. And the combination of German expressionism, which was the filmmaking style that James Whale pioneered with Universal Studios, to marry that particular visual style to those kind of stories, you know, it made history. I actually think you can look at those films as a filmmaker, looking at it from a filmmaker's perspective. You look at those films and you see the sheer filmmaking brilliance on display. It was a winning formula. Audiences turned up for these kinds of movies for 20 years. You know, the Marvel films are kind of like a flash in the pan, right? We had about a decade of them, and then everybody said, okay, we're kind of tired of this, but they don't know what they're doing. Audiences turned up for these films from 1931 all the way through 54, I think, is when The Creature from the Black Lagoon came out. People found these films fascinating, and the characters and the monsters fascinating. And I think one of the things with monster films specifically, which is really what they are, many of those Universal films, those classic horror films, are monster films, and that's a subgenre unto itself, a very important one. I think what they see and what those films thematically were working with is the idea that sometimes, frequently, the biggest monster in the room is the human and not the monster himself. It's the same theme that that classic film, The Elephant Man, will deal with. In fact, The Elephant Man being shot in black and white and incorporating the style, the visual style of the Universal Studios classic monster films, that was no coincidence at all. It was very intentionally done. You have the character, the monster, if you will, of Frankenstein. Just to be clear on this, when we say Frankenstein, we're not talking about the monster. We're talking about Victor Frankenstein, the guy who creates it. The monster is, you know, for all intents and purposes, called Frankenstein's monster. So when Frankenstein, that's the scientist Victor, Henry in the film, actually, his name has changed, creates the monster. The monster is this sort of, in a sense, innocent figure. He's monstrous, and he's grotesque to look at. But there's an innocence about him. There's a childlike innocence about him. And he's played, you know, by Boris Karloff. This is the iconic nubs on the neck, flat top look that everybody associates with Frankenstein, though it is nothing like what Mary Shelley originally wrote. This is the image we all have of Frankenstein. That comes straight from Boris Karloff and the portrayal in the 31 film. This idea of the monster being innocent and childlike, which is there in the novel in many ways. Had Victor, his creator, not sort of abandoned his own creation and become so horrified by what he's made that he just sort of leaves it to its own devices, one has to ask the question, well, would the monster ever have been as monstrous as he was? The monster is only a monster because Victor, or Henry in the film, is a monster himself. He's a coward. And if Frankenstein simply had not been a coward and had owned his mistakes and had taken responsibility for the genie he had let out of the bottle, if he had taken responsibility for having opened Pandora's box, you might have seen a very different outcome. But instead, you see this monster sort of innocently, without knowing, running amok and destroying things and killing people, even killing children, simply because it doesn't know any better. It's looking for some kind of connection. That its creator, its father, if you will, just refuses to give it. Now, you can easily get into subjects of Christianity there. We would argue that God is not like Victor Frankenstein at all. And yet we see in that film, in that story, that you have a grotesque, monstrous thing, and yet the biggest monster of all is the human who created him. That's the kind of thing that I think audiences latched onto in their day. It's very compelling. And it's why these characters endure. It's why these films endure. It's why you see them, you know, playing out on reruns on TV. Even today, people are drawn to that kind of thing. They like those stories, even if they're not as popular as they used to be. And there's a lot of superficiality today, right? When you just throw in some gore and guts, it's that to me is like the CGI we see. It's window dressing. And a lot of films, especially these slasher films, have no depth of thought to them. It's the same thing that Ebert picked up on when he was watching the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, when he said it seems like it's just without purpose. It's there and it's interesting to watch, but there's no there. There's no substance there. And you can't say that for these early films. And that's simply because they're based on literature that had a lot of there.
This is a fascinating conversation. We probably could talk for another 30 minutes or an hour, but I just want to end up with this one because this is pretty provocative. So at the end of your article, you claim, you
put a thesis out that we could be living in Mary Shelley's nightmare in the 21st century. What do you mean by that? And do you think that contributes to why we're going to see fewer horror films that have like maybe more of a theme or a motif to them or some kind of underlying purpose as to why they're being made?
Yeah, so this idea, the thesis of it for me began when I was teaching the film unit of a class on monster literature. So the not very novels that we're talking about, I was asked to teach a unit for a couple of days on horror films by one of the creators of this class. And so I put together this unit and I taught it the first time around, and it was just sort of a superficial look at horror films, what makes a horror film, that kind of thing. And it did okay, but it wasn't the greatest. And about a year later, over that year, I really dug into the older horror things. I sort of went back to my roots, if you will, in the genre. And I was looking at what sort of the whole thing we've been talking about here. What makes those early classic horror films, monster films, again, so different from what is being made today? And I realized, well, one of the things is we just don't see them anymore. Again, you never see Dracula portrayed as evil. And if he is portrayed as evil, it's always with some, like, again, gussied up special effect kind of thing. We never see evil with a face. We never see all of our villains have to be sympathetic nowadays, you know? And I'm watching it and I'm thinking through why do we not see these kinds of films being made anymore? Why do we not see a real sort of baseline morality in a lot of the horror films we make? And then I don't even know how this sort of came to me. I think I was just having a moment where I was looking at the culture at large and I realized, oh, well, if you look at everything Mary Shelley was writing about, sort of like putting her fears on the page, if you will, she was very concerned about the triumph of science over God, right? That's really what Frankenstein is. There's actually a film that I think includes that line. It's the triumph of science over God. It's Victor creating life through science. He's doing God's work. He's transgressing. It's forbidden knowledge. This idea of there are things we ought not know. There are things that humans ought not probe into because it's not for them. The creation of life would be one of those. This would be Frankenstein. And I realized, oh, well, the reason we don't see these kinds of films being made or why they seem kind of rote and boring to us is because this is the world we actually live in. And it starts in the 20th century, I think, which is when these films were gaining traction. So in this class, one of the things we look at is we go all the way back to things like eugenics, World War II. We look at the Japanese Unit 731. We look at the trade-off where America and the West received, you know, their records. There were some deals that were sort of made there where some people got immunity who probably shouldn't have in exchange for their records. And so we actually learned a lot of good things in the medical realm. We learned how to treat certain things like frostbite based on those records. But those records were learned because they were experimenting on prisoners of war. This is not conspiracy theory stuff, folks. This is just Google it.
Right. It's really hard. I mean, I think modern people don't believe that's true, you know, especially.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I started teaching.
They respect or, yes, you know, things like that. Yeah. Like Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood. Did you know she was involved in eugenics?
Yes, exactly. And so this is why I started teaching this unit in this way. And this became my thesis of the whole thing. And so we not only look at that, but we look at things like gene editing, which we don't even bat an eye at today. We look at things like CRISPR-Cas9, which, by the way, and I always plug this show, but especially given the content, what we're talking about, The X-Files was telling stories about CRISPR back in the 90s. Like, this show, ahead of its time, every time I turn around, I'm finding another layer to it. It's absolutely fantastic and wonderful. And it sort of is rooted in all these ideas and deals with very similar themes and things like that. Really worth your time. Anyway, we look at all of these things in this class. And sort of the conclusion I reach is the reason you see fewer and fewer of these horror films with a purpose today has largely to do with the fact that I think we're actually living in Mary Shelley's nightmare. This is all of the stuff that she saw coming with the advent of progress, with the advent of science, with the advent of, and you know, pushing forward, enlightenment, progress, run amok, unchecked. It's why, of all films, Jurassic World, the first one, I'm watching it, and you know, Chris Pratt's character has the line where they're talking about, you know, creating this new and cool dinosaur, and look at all the stuff we can do, and gene editing, and we're going to create this. And he finally says, well, you know, maybe progress should lose for a change. And I thought, how did this movie make money? How did people not get up and walk out of the theater when he said that? Because this is not the philosophy of the day at all. It's not in the warp and woof of the air today. I vividly remember seeing that in the film and being in the theater and being like blown away that that line was even passed or even made it into a mainstream film. But it's that same idea that's at work here, that progress left unchecked, scientific advancement left unchecked, it might actually become quite horrific. And I think this is what we see today. We're living in it. That's why. It seems tame to us by comparison. Well, why would you make a Frankenstein? Or if you do make Frankenstein, there's got to be a twist. There's got to be some, you know, hyper-sexual Freudian twist to the whole affair. There's a couple of Frankenstein films I saw recently, and that's what they are. And Dracula's the same way. Now, Dracula can't just be evil. He's got to be sympathetic. We have to give him an origin story. We have to do Dracula Untold. He's actually a sympathetic character who becomes Dracula to... You know, because there's the love of his life that he's falling for, he's trying to save. I mean, it's nonsense. Evil can't just be evil. It has to be medicated, remedied, explained. And you know what? At the end of the day, evil is basically just good gone awry. That's what we're going to argue. It's, you know, Dracula doing the right thing for the wrong reasons. No, no, no. None of this stuff is there in those original works. And I do think in a very real sense that we sort of live in Mary Shelley's nightmare today.
Speaking of Freudian and over-sexualized interpretations, there's one coming out with the actress, the Oscar-winning actress Emma Stone, called Poor Things, and it's based on that, but they're using a woman as the Frankenstein. So
there you go. See, I honestly didn't even
recommend.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
The trailer in the movie theater.
You know, what's funny is I didn't even know that was coming out. Didn't even know. Have never even heard of it, but doesn't surprise me.
Oh, and anyone should watch the trailer. And that's what it's actually what it is from what I
understand. See? How did I know that?
It's a feminist take on sexual liberation through the repression of society through someone, some guy, I guess, Willem Dafoe's character making this woman who is like a Frankenstein. And I would say, and so it's very sexually graphic is my understanding, even though it's rated R, maybe it's a rated super hard R, but I would say, before I realized what was going on, I saw the beginning of it. They only briefly show the sexual thing, but you could realize, well, this is going to be crazy. Mm-hmm. Is that she does a good job. I mean, the acting of like, wow, that seems like a Frankenstein-like creature. But I don't think that's the original source material. It had nothing to do with the sexual oppression of women.
No, sorry. You know, there are certain readings I hear of those classics and even the classic films, right, that I think, oh, you know, that's interesting. And then there are others I hear and I think, what planet? I can promise you. That was not, and it's easy to do with the 1931 Frankenstein because James Whale, who made it, was one of Hollywood's earliest openly gay film directors. So you see a lot of things now, research, writing coming out that Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, it's all about the sexual repression that he was, you know, living out and how he was ostracized from society. You know, listening to him talk and reading him in interviews, I don't know. He doesn't seem to say that. So I get it. I didn't even know that film was a thing, but it doesn't surprise
me. Yes, it is a thing. It is being touted for awards and it's being released.
Of course it is. Of course it is.
And it's nothing like that. Well, finally, I don't know if it's a lighter note, but maybe just a recommendation from you. If someone wants to say, okay, I don't need to see the newer genres, you know, slasher and so forth, but I do want to consider a horror film because I would say that even people into slashers and things, they have seen some of the original classics, some of those, you know, Universal Studios classics.
what's one or two films that you would say this is good and it would even be appropriate maybe for, you know, because they're so popular with high school students, here's one that's a classic that you could show your high schooler and have a good conversation about how they could be equipped to use it as
springboard. This is a great question. Cause I was talking about this, with just some of the other teachers at the high school, showing one of these films. My all time favorite has been, The Wolfman, the Lon Chaney Wolfman film, The Wolfman, written by Kurt Siodmak. That film has layers, it has depths, it deals with fate. It's truly, truly scary, I think, in some ways. But again, it's bloodless. It's a bloodless film. There's no gore. There's no real sexuality to it. But I think that film is one that could easily be watched. And have great conversations about with themes of, again, fate and destiny. That the original screenplay was called Destiny. So there you go. It tells you some of the themes that are in it. Everybody sort of knows the Lugosi and Karloff, Dracula and Frankenstein. Those are classics, you know, for a reason. Watch them. I think that's completely safe and tame. I will say, if you're looking for something a little more modern, I don't know that you could show this one to kids because it is a little graphic. But it is so well done, and I think it has a very, very important read on evil. It has a very nuanced understanding of how evil works, because the villain, you know, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler, but it's a bit of a spoiler here. The villain is the devil, and you don't really sort of realize it until the last moment, but it's so subtle and sinister and accurate with how Satan works. He doesn't come, you know, it's sort of the antithesis of the Exorcist film. It's the antithesis of the exorcism movie, because he bides his time. He waits until you have nothing, and then he offers you the world. The film is Robert Eggers' film, The Witch. I saw that film when I was a Bible student in college at Moody Bible Institute. I was having a terrible day. I vividly remember this. I was having a terrible day. And I sort of walked in and told my roommate, like, I have to go to a movie. I'm done. So I went to the theater, I think it was an Arclight theater. And I walked in, there was a film called The Witch playing. I said, I have no clue what this is. I'm going to buy a ticket to it, bought a ticket to it. And I walked out of that film changed. It's the kind of movie that you experience a darkness when you watch it, that it purges you of the darkness. Because it's so, you come out with a sharpened sense of what evil is. You go in, you know, sort of in a malaise, and you walk out and go, I have a very clear understanding of evil, and therefore I have a clear understanding of goodness. And it really, I did. I walked back into that room, and he said, what happened? I said, I just saw an amazing movie. So tough film to watch, but not really because of gore or anything like that, just because it's genuinely horrifying in terms of just watching this family, a very sort of, in a sense, faithful family, tear itself apart. And then this evil sort of lingering in the background. Very, very good film. So I would recommend The Witch as a modern horror film done extremely well, very scary too, that you can watch and I think you'd be okay with.
Well, thanks again for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 363 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. I've been having a conversation today with Cole Burgett about his online cultural apologetics feature Viewpoint article called Oh the Horror, One Christian's Analysis of a Controversial Genre. Cole tackles horror films in this article, and you can read it for free at our website, equip.org.
Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that, and every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.